Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Businessology Show. We are, I think, going into our 11th year. And so we bring some great guests on here to talk about agencies and growth, profitability, metrics, things that I love to talk about. So really pumped. We've had David Baker on our show a while back. It's been a long time. I can't even remember. So David is going to be joining us again. And so you know David Baker if you listen to our show. So New York Times five-time author. He says hopelessly homeless politically and spiritually, but a strong point of view, but attempts to remain epistemologically humble. So thankful for that. You also know him as the other half of the Two Bobs podcast that he and Blair do. Great show. And The Business of Expertise, his book, probably one of my most suggested and offered books to a lot of our clients. So what we're going to do is a part two show. This is part one of a part two. And part two is really going to center more on his book that he wrote a while back, Financial Management of a Marketing Firm, something I would be pretty interested in. Part one, this show right now, is going to be a little bit higher level. So I'm pumped to have David on the show. So David Baker, thanks for joining us on the Businessology Show. I appreciate it.
Glad to do it. This is my last big thing of the week. I don't usually do anything on Friday to do something like this. It's fun. This is my third appearance today on different things, and I've really been looking forward to doing this. I appreciate the role that you and your team have on the industry, in the industry.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we can say the same for you and a lot of other thought leaders, Blair. And so we just really appreciate all that you guys do with a lot of, interest in education. I am interested, just David, to dive in. Like you have degrees in history and theology. So what was your journey to kind of get here? Now you're an expert in the agency profession, of course, have been for a long time. But what got you from there to here?
Oh, it's such a weird winding path. I'm a U.S. citizen, so I was born in the U.S., but then when I was young, my parents were medical missionaries, so we went overseas when I was five, and I didn't come back to live in the U.S. till I was almost 20, so I didn't really have much exposure here. We lived in this little village up in the mountains, no electricity, no running water, no roads. It was pretty remote. Mm-hmm. And when I came to the U.S., I was thinking that I went, high school, college, and then grad school for 5 years full time. And I was headed to teaching linguistics and anthropology. That was what I was really interested in. Mm-hmm. But I just had sort of a revelation in the middle of all that around the lack of academic freedom and decided, I'm really glad that I did all this work, but I don't really want to do this as a profession. And I'm looking around in town and noticing the quality of the ads, and they just sucked, honestly. And I thought, oh, man, I could do better than this. I wasn't very humble at the time. So as I was managing a publisher and doing typesetting in foreign languages and responsible for their marketing, and just sort of took that experience to running a firm. So I had an independent firm. We were small, 16 people. Five and a half years. And where the story gets interesting is that I didn't know anything about business at the time. And so I was subscribing and reading regularly a publication called Creative Business. It isn't around anymore. And Cam Foote, who ran that, said, hey, why don't you, there's a couple subjects that I don't feel as comfortable writing about. Would you dive into them? And in his case, that was finance, which was something I knew nothing about either.
It's like he picked the expert. Me.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to admit that because I love the idea of getting published. So anyway, so then he asked me to help him with his seminars. He'd split them up. He'd do the interesting cities. I'd get the boring ones. And then one day he said to me, and this is where everything turned on. He said to me, hey, David, why don't you do consulting, Cam, to your readers. And he wasn't interested for his own reasons. And he said, why don't you do it? I'll put an ad in the publication. You give me 10% of everything you make.
Wow.
So that was really the launching of my career, because people started calling, and it just very quickly took over what I did. And since then, that was 28 years ago. Since then, I've just been learning a lot every year.
Yeah. Wow. That's a cool journey. And that's a journey we hear when we read about consultants, that general term that means different things to different people. But a lot of times they got accidentally forced into some kind of consulting environment. Right. All the all the ones I follow, they really, they just got, you know, that somebody accidentally said, will you help me?
Right.
And they, you just start helping people. And that is a lot of what consulting is. You're helping people. Is it mostly you consult with people that are in trouble or they're fearful or they're trying to unravel some mistake? Is that what you're doing in consulting?
There is a big part of the consulting work that comes exactly from that angle. Then there are others who there's nothing wrong, but say they want to sell their firm. And so everything's going really well, right? Or others who just say, you know what? I feel like I've nailed all the things that got me to here, but I think it's going to take different things to take me to that next level. So I don't do as much emergency sort of work. Most of it is just, hey, I'd like an outside perspective. Somebody, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. Let's just bring somebody in. But isn't consulting weird? Because, you know, there's no program, there's no college program for that.
To
be a good consultant, you have to be articulate, you have to be intelligent, you have to be observant, and you have to be pretty bold too. So it's so interesting how consulting is so important to our world, but it people who come to it from, they come to it from very different perspectives.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's why it has the label that it does, like, you know, the jokes about consulting, you know, the, you know, and there's movies, you know, obviously made about that stuff. So, but it, it actually is very transformative. And it's funny, you have a degree in anthropology. It is a, it's a serious people work. So you're not only working with a business, but there's this entrepreneur in front of you that's really misbehaving or blowing the company up, or actually they're, you know, they feel like they're God to everybody. And you have to speak to a person and start to coach them and get pretty in their face or help them when they're fearful. So they're, I mean, do you find what percentage of it is really helping that human overcome their own personal weaknesses?
Yeah. Well, and then here I am trying to overcome my personal weaknesses and working with somebody else to overcome their personal weaknesses.
Yeah.
It's very, very true. I remember reading one of Michael Gerber's early books called The E-Myth Revisited, and he said in there a statement that's really struck with me. It's that most entrepreneurs are technicians who've suffered an entrepreneurial seizure.
Yeah.
So they didn't come into, they didn't come into the field knowing how to run a business. They came into the field knowing something technically, whether that was design or programming, and now they want to run a business with, and how to run a business is very different than knowing how to do something that your company does. And it's also, like you said, intensely personal. So I when I think about my own consulting career, where I made a pretty big leap was when I took a personality profile for myself and discovered, oh my goodness, now I understand why that sets me off, why that makes me angry. Or and so I've incorporated a lot of that work into my consulting because we do come to our decisions as people. And so we're not all that objective. We have to understand where our tendencies are.
Yeah. And that's, well, and it's hard, right? It's hard for us to see our own issues often without the help of a counselor, therapist, or a coach. And so it makes sense that consultants are valuable. What do you think we do consulting, but it's with entrepreneurs. These happen to be very particular people. They can be chaotic, huge personalities, little blind, you know, pretty self-aggrandizing, however you say that. And some of them come in and they say, I became an entrepreneur because I'm addicted to freedom, or I want to live in an unencumbered way. And they have this label of freedom that they're seeking in entrepreneurship. And sometimes we find that the root of that, it becomes a lot of their problems because they don't lean into the structure that larger entities, like if an entrepreneur grows, they mislabel freedom to be something that, that starts to really hurt them because they don't live within a structured system that actually will allow a company, a human-based organization, to scale. How often do you find the entrepreneur is in their own way, I guess, as a phrase we could say?
Well, I think it's not as bad as it used to be, maybe because we have so many good examples of excellent management practices, but it's still there for sure. And I see exactly what you're talking about frequently, where an entrepreneur will, let's say it's a male and he thinks back to his experience, and one of the things he hated at the firm he worked with before he launched his own was timesheets, for instance. He goes, and one of his vows is, we're never going to have timesheets. Mm-hmm. And then he realizes, oh, well, maybe there's a purpose for them temporarily. But now I'm a little embarrassed because I just said we don't need them, right?
Right.
Or they manage employees as if they are just the same, when in fact employees are not generally entrepreneurial. They want more structure than the typical entrepreneur wants. So trying to do them a favor, you give them all kinds of freedom when in fact they're actually craving a little bit more structure, job title, reporting, relationships, frequent reviews, and all of that sort of thing. I did a really interesting experiment, and it was unintentional. I was trying to study roles and how people work together and how much of each one you need and how they interact and all that stuff. And so in the process of that, I spent $300,000+ and 23,000 people were subjects in this study.
And wow, that's cool.
At the end of the study, I realized that, oh my goodness, I have 1,340 principals in here. I wonder what I could, in that group of 23,000, I wonder what I could learn from them.
Yeah. And
so I started with the personality profile side to see if there was any pattern, like introvert, extrovert, organized or not, objective or not. And there was only one, there was a single common characteristic of the 1,340 principals. All but four of them had this common characteristic, and it was that they were not risk averse. So they were willing to take risks.
Okay. Wow.
And
wow.
There was nothing
else unexpected.
In common.
That's unexpected, really.
Yeah. And because they're willing to take risks, they tend to make lots of decisions, and a lot of them are wrong, but there are enough correct ones that it saves them from the bad ones. And so it's always really shaped how I think about these people. In fact, if you have somebody who you're thinking of making a partner and they're risk averse, then just don't do it. Like, they're not going to be good.
That's right. That's so cool. But it's when you work with entrepreneurs, after a while, you start to really care. We really love the entrepreneurial person. They can really see the value of having an objective person. We ask them, are you familiar with coaching? They're all in therapy. So they're like, oh yeah, man, I know how to seek advice from other people, especially the healthier ones. They're like, I realized a long time ago how unhealthy I can be on my own or being alone. And they happen to be just such powerful people, but sometimes so, you know, the underbelly is so soft, sometimes very scared people, and they want somebody to take care of them so they can go conquer the world. And it's so cool. You can really provide some structure and care and guidance, and it really does promote them to go do amazing things. Have you found that in the entrepreneurs you care for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think, but that sometimes it'll come from, a spouse or a friend a partner or a consultant, right? And I actually don't do any coaching, and it's because my personality is a really bad fit for it. I tend to, because I'm just not patient enough. I just why in the world didn't you do that? It's like, don't come back to me until you do it. Like, that's not great coaching. So I tend to be way more episodic, where I step in, analyze something, suggest what to do differently, and then just let them go off on their own. But I do think coaching has a significant role. People generally are way more self-aware of how they are in the business world. And then I think our world doesn't let you get away with some of the bad behavior that was pretty prominent in the entrepreneurial world. So that's all good, I think.
Okay. No, that makes sense. Yeah, it's just much more, we live out much more in the public now, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
So kind of switching over to agencies and businesses, and, you know, they become different as they grow. Some entrepreneurs have different goals. Some we find want to just blow up a company, scale it huge, sell it in 5 years. Some are just methodical. You know, they'll plod for 30 years, create something, you know, immensely valuable that they can transition as a legacy to other owners. Is there a right or wrong way to that? Or would you guide somebody that's trying to scale something huge and sell to kind of stay in the game a little bit longer? Or how would you consult with people on different sides of that balance?
Well, the first thing I want to make sure of is that whatever their approach, it fits who they are. I think what would be wrong would be for somebody who doesn't want to manage growth to decide they need to grow. And so I just find that that's a very amoral, sort of an ethical decision. So I don't, I want somebody to decide on growth based on the role that they want to have. So if they still want to be close to the work or close to the clients or one or both, then they shouldn't grow, because it's just, it's going to really fall apart. The business is going to demand some things of you that you're not willing to do because you're head down still doing the work. But if you love the challenge of building a growing, thriving, exciting organization, then I think that's a fantastic way to go. But I don't think one way is better or the other. Yeah. I think it just needs to be a fit for your personality.
Okay. And maybe would that entrepreneur not always know early in their agency career what they should do? A lot of them are very confused. Would you counsel them through that? You kind of help them go, I mean, would you say, from what you've told me, it sounds like you probably should go this way, not the way you've been going. Would you give them that kind of advice?
For sure. And sometimes I'm the only person that's spoken into their world that directly, because you can see the signals that they are embracing management or they're not embracing management. Nobody in their right mind comes into this field primarily driven by the desire to make money. There are just so many easier ways to make money. You get into this field because you love the work. And then you keep asking yourself the question, what do I want to do? And your answer will change frequently. And so you have to keep asking yourself that question and then make sure that the business is yours and the business doesn't own you. So here's an example. This sort of touches on something you said earlier. People start these businesses sometimes right out of school, but usually after they've worked for somebody else in the field.
Right.
And they do it because they feel like, okay, I could make more money. I wouldn't have to work as hard. I could control the clients that we have. Those are three big reasons. And then 4 years later, 7 years later, they wake up and said, all right, let's just ask myself these questions. Am I working less? Am I making more? Do I have more control over my clients? I had one boss before. Now I've got 20 bosses.
Right.
And they wake up and they realize, oh my God, this is based on why I started this. This is a failed enterprise. And so then they wake up and say, I've got to be in charge of my business again. I can't be thrown around. I can't be I don't want the tail wagging the dog here. I need to own my business again. And that's when they either have a wake up call, and sometimes it involves asking for outside help like me or somebody like me, and other times it doesn't. Yeah.
Man, it's tough for them to come to those realizations. This would be anecdotally, but what would maybe the team size be at a point in an agency where that owner that maybe was a technician that was coming in as a, you know, a creative design technician needs to switch into becoming an operator? At what team size becomes too unwieldy or too big enough to still stay in the design? You got to move out into the CEO position. Is there an anecdotal team range size you would give?
There is. So what you do is you figure out all the things that you're doing and you think about, okay, what can I give up and what must I retain? So the things you have to give up as the firm grows are these things in order. You've got to give up the project management side of things that is keeping in your head the details of what's going on. And that hits you at about 5 or 6 people total. The second thing you've got to give up is managing any client relationship. So you've got to have a professional in that role. who can grow accounts, who can manage conflict, who can pull information from clients, can address pricing issues and scope creep and all that. And that's somewhere in the 8-9 people, something like that. But that still leaves a fair bit of time for you to do some of the things that maybe you love, whether you're a designer or you're an artist or you're a writer and so on. But when the firm gets in the double digits, you've got to be a CEO. You've got to be managing the new business funnel.
Yeah.
You've got to be getting the right people in the level right below you. You've got to be watching financial performance really carefully. Those are the three big things. So if you aren't committed to doing what the business needs from you at that size, and you have your head down doing other things, the business will begin to take over your life in bad ways and will demand things of you. It'll just say, you need to start paying attention to me. Here's why, because you're going to miss payroll if you don't, or whatever it is, right?
Okay, yeah. And so that's a kind of a turning point when they're like, I have to actually focus on the business. It's too unwieldy. It needs enough care for there to be an executive position to lead the visionary side of it. I got to step out of design. And is there anecdotally a team size where, you know, because I think this is a tough position to hand off, is that sales biz dev side. I think a lot of agency owners try to get rid of that sooner than it works. There's a number of failed attempts sometimes. Is there a right size of an agency to get rid of that, that intake of that new revenue, the pricing of it, and things like that?
Well, I should note that principals are really bad at pricing. They usually price things way too low.
Yeah.
So the more you can hand that off to somebody who's more objective and is driven by whatever it takes to get it done profitably, the better off you are. The sales function is often delegated way too early, only because the principal doesn't think he or she is good at it or doesn't enjoy it. And so they realize the important role of new business, but they don't want to do it. And so they give it off to somebody else, which seldom works. I think what you can do, so I think of the whole new business process in three stages. One is deciding your positioning, and that you don't need to revisit, but every few years. Second would be where most of the work occurs, and that's the whole lead generation side. So inbound and outbound, and that can very safely be delegated to the right person. And then the third phase is what I just call closing, and that's being a part of the conversation when a right fit prospect comes to you and says, hey, let's talk about working together. And I don't think that should ever be delegated. It doesn't mean that every principal needs to be a part of it, but at least one of them needs to be involved in new business. The prospect needs to believe that this is so significant in the history of the firm that we dragged the principal out of bed, dressed him up, and reeled him in, and he had something to say, and then we sent him back. But it just needs to happen that way.
Okay, that makes sense. And it, you know, maybe you can answer this question. Why does it seldom work when they hand it off? Is it, I think a lot of times they'll view that business development salesperson as, well, if I can go get the rock star, right, I'm going to get somebody at 175 grand, they're going to really be able to do sales better than me. And that's not necessarily true. Why is that area so difficult? Why does it rarely work when they try to hand it off the first time, maybe?
Yeah. Well, because usually when they're handing it off, they're handing it off in an outbound context. So you have somebody who is going to work the phone, and they have 100 contacts, and they're contacting the same ones. And then when they leave, because they feel like they're not making enough money, they're going to take those contacts with them. And you've basically been borrowing a salesperson's Rolodex for a period of time, sort of leasing it. But it's not a permanent lease, and then they'll leave
you. Okay.
But I think it can be very effective to use another employee to put a really thoughtful marketing plan in place that's more inbound in nature. That can work really well.
Okay. So when you're building your team, and I think entrepreneurs get get a thought in their mind where I'm just going to hire this person. I know they're going to cost me a lot, but I'm ready to invest in that person. And so an outside hire, especially a very pivotal role like business development or something like that, can be pretty risky, right? Because it may not work. When do you tell people work? Try to promote, right? How do you promote from within? Of course, that takes much longer, but it can be more cost effective and people can be more bought into your culture. How do you know when to say, promote that role, work on that over 5 years to get it to the role you need it to be, or hire outside and bring a large role at the top in? How do you know when to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of it depends on how good the firm has been historically in finding, screening, and then training people. And if they've been effective at that, then that would always be the first approach you'd take. If they haven't been effective, then you almost have to hire the more expensive people.
Okay.
And that's obviously a riskier approach. Mm. I favor hiring a few really, really skilled people at certain roles, and then, but for most of the roles, just having a really active recruiting campaign. I've felt for about a decade now that it's actually harder to find good team members than it is to find good clients. Good clients are almost everywhere. Mm. Finding the right people on your team is a much more challenging, but a much more rewarding thing to do. There's a pretty big movement to nearshore or offshore team members as well. And that can work really well for certain roles, not for other roles. Mm-hmm. So we haven't really figured out, we haven't settled into a comfortable place. We're still experimenting a lot with this.
Okay. And it makes sense what you're saying. And just to reiterate what you said it's maybe in the past decade been harder to find team members than it is clients.
Right.
And is that a generational change? I mean, this especially the digital agency profession has not been around very long. Is it more that the profession's not that old, or is it generations are changing and people are different now? Or what is driving that, do you think?
Well, there's probably, I haven't studied it thoroughly, but my instinct tells me that there's more turnover in the sense that people in the field have discovered that it's not a life sentence to work in this field, they have many possibilities. Once they've exceeded as an employee, as a team member in this field, they have lots more options than they used to. So you have, for instance, a lot of the tech firms are sort of taking the very best people with promises of more money. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it, right? Schools have generally done a very poor job of preparing people for the real world in this space. And so we're having to recruit from other areas. Like if you look at some of the areas where we're getting non-traditional employees from, it's from elementary ed and from the legal profession and for very specific reasons, right? And so when you're going to find somebody that hasn't come from a traditional background, you've got to look in many more places and you have to screen them much more carefully. So it's just a lot more work to find. In the past, if you needed a designer, you'd go to maybe RISD or Pratt or, you know, one of those, you know, one of the big name schools. And if you got the top one or two second person in that class, it was probably a safe decision. Mm. Well, hiring is way more complicated than that nowadays.
Oh, and man.
It's fun though. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. And when you find that person, you know, you're so thankful that the person you find that's committed to their role, you know, that's committed to the mission or the purpose you kind of, you know, gave them when you're orienting them into the firm is much better, even if they're not technically that far along, because you can really take somebody with a heart for the work of that company and transform them. It's going to take a while, but they get pretty deeply embedded in the culture. It's so hiring, great hiring, I guess, becomes a long-term game, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. Like I do a lot of work with repositioning firms, so figuring out what their business strategy is, and then we built a marketing plan on top of it. Mm. And I've felt like we should be doing the same sort of work for employees. But the positioning there is the culture, and and that exists, and it's usually very strong. What we're missing is a marketing plan for people. We have a marketing plan for clients, but we don't have a marketing plan for people. And I think that's one of the roles that a principal should have, as a constant marketing plan for people.
Ah, which maybe in the past 10 years sounds like that's a new role that now an executive needs to take on, which is a marketing plan for continued hiring of people, something maybe they didn't have to have 10 right. years ago. So they have to shed something else to now take this new role on that the profession demands of them now, I guess. Is that right?
Right, exactly right. And the rapid turnover on the surface seems like a terrible thing. It's a big obstacle that we have to keep addressing. I want principals to think of it as an advantage that you bring people in and they work with you for 2 or 3 years and you don't try to hang on to those people. You just recognize that your firm is really unique and vibrant because of the steady stream of people. They're not leaving for bad reasons. They're not leaving because your culture sucks. They're leaving because there's other opportunities, and that doesn't frighten you. And it forces you to have a business that can bring people up to speed really quickly. We're not depending, the business isn't depending on really smart people who are using their intuition to just do good work. No, it's more systems or model driven, where we can plug more ordinary people in because they're easier to find.
Yeah.
Very cool. That's the philosophy.
That's cool. Well, okay, so let's switch a little bit to you know, the situation that our world's been in the past 3 years, and the kind of the financial ride of the up and down that we've seen agencies in the past couple of years. And since, you know, we only serve digital agencies in our firm, we have definitely seen patterns. What patterns have you seen financially, as far, maybe more focused on the agency's revenue coming in? Like, when does revenue stagnate? When has it? Why is it now? Is it up? Is it down? What are you seeing in the profession?
Well, 2.5 years ago in March of 2020, remember, we were all sitting around. We had no idea what's happening. We're wiping off our Amazon packages to save our lives and doing a lot of meaningless stuff. Mm-hmm. And then for, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks, there was a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen. You'd get the PPP money and you think, this is saving my life. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, you look at the balance sheet and you realize you've not spent a single dime of the PPP money, that things were not nearly as bad as you thought they were going to be. And so I think overall, firms are in really good shape. Some of the weak kids got thrown off the merry-go-round while it was spinning during the early days of COVID, but the rest of them are actually strong. They're more bulletproof. They've understood their business fundamentals way better than they ever have. So 21 was a pretty darn good year. 2022 feels a little bit soft, but our feelings are not really reflected in the numbers. The firms are generally doing pretty well right now, but I think there's enough uncertainty about the world stage and about politics in the U.S. and the recession that we're apparently in, depending on your definition. So it doesn't feel great, but the business results have been pretty strong so far.
Interesting. Well, and also it's wild, through COVID, that wasn't the only thing going on, right? Politically, culturally, and now globally, you know, financially, all other things have been going on that are making it difficult. And you're saying that's just a school of hard knocks. The ones that are left over are just, they may not even feel great, but they're just stronger now.
Yeah, right. I mean, those of us that have been around a while can see how these things happen, like 2001, 2008, 2009, COVID. And so when there's a dip in your numbers, top line or bottom line, you realize, oh, okay, well, that's going to happen. It's a season. I need to adjust pretty quickly. I need to watch things carefully, but this is not fatal. We'll get through this, right?
Yeah. What do you tell them? Listen, you need to have 3 to 6 months of cash, you know, in the bank. Like, you know, what do you tell them as a key to kind of moving forward to stay healthy?
Yeah, absolutely. You got to have a cash cushion. You have to be willing to react really quickly to staffing changes that are necessary. I've never heard anybody say, darn it, I wish I had waited longer before I made a layoff, right? They all say, I wish I'd done it earlier.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things are really critical. And then there are other things that are almost too late to do once you hit a downturn, but you could certainly work on it right now. And that's to have a sort of a, I don't know, a big flywheel spun up all the time doing your basic marketings, because it takes too long. If you start your marketing right now at the beginning of a downturn, it's usually not going to hit until later. So you want to keep that spinning all the time. Those would be the big things I'd concentrate on.
Yeah. No, that's really good stuff. One thing, you know, like you said, and it sounds like you're saying, the past decade, hiring good people has consistently been something that's been hard, and it's really hard now. And the labor market is so weird that people are having to hire new people in sometimes at salaries much higher than the people that have been in the agency for 5 years. And so it really starts, it's feeling really weird to entrepreneurs to get sometimes more the same or a junior person that has to come in at a higher price than a senior person that's been on their team. What do you do about that? Do you go bump everybody up 15% to the person you just hired? Like, what do you do?
Well, I think you need to be proactive. So I think if you have an employee that you really want to keep who comes to you and says, hey, I really, really need to talk about my comp here. Yeah. You've already missed the boat. You should be proactive about those kinds of conversations, especially if somebody is saying, listen, I just got this offer. I don't want to take it. But is there anything you can do in my comp? It's like, no, that's not the time to adjust it. So I'm sympathetic with all of that, but I think you just got to do the right thing at the right time and not worry too much about the consequences and not try to hang on to people that are too expensive. That's probably the biggest challenge we have right now. Fortunately, it's slowed down a little bit, but the challenge is, how do we keep what we're paying people in line with normal standards here? And unless you're going to make a lot more money to cover this, then there's going to be a problem.
Man, that is tough. So you're saying if by the time a team member comes to you, a great team member, and they say, hey, I don't want to leave our culture, but I am being offered, you know, 30 grand more. Like that's not insignificant. You're saying you're too late. That's not the time to give them that 30 grand bump to match. And why is that? Because they're still going to be unhappy another year later? Or
there would be some cases where somebody would come to you like that and you would say, oh, you know what, this is something I've been meaning to talk with you about for a while. I feel bad that you had to bring it up, and you give them a bump, and that makes sense. But I think in most cases it's too late and you just need to let them go. You kind of like in your mind you want to say, is there anybody here that's significantly underpaid right now? If they are, let me fix that. Let me take the initiative. This is partly driven by the personality type. So the personality type of an entrepreneur is somebody who is not risk averse. The flip side of that is that entrepreneurs who are not risk averse hate being taken advantage of or feeling they're out of control. And so they don't get the emotional benefit of raising somebody's comp if somebody has to raise that idea to them. That's another reason why it needs to be very proactive.
Wow, that's amazing. So as we work with agencies, we'll see them be able, I don't know, sometimes out of fear to try to scale their labor through their contractors. And it seems at some point they need to move that over to a team model, right? The investment in that fixed labor. And sometimes that's a point of fear. Sometimes they do it too fast. Sometimes they don't flex their labor through their contractors enough. Or there's some kind of proper use of contractor expense to fixed labor on your team. How do you know? Like, how do you scale and get that right? Which one do you lean on most when you're in a movement of scaling? You're getting larger.
I do want to answer that, but I want to draw attention to the fact that I think the answer is different for different positions. For instance, the core positions that I do not feel should ever be managed through a contractor relationship would be your account management team, your project management team, and your strategists.
Okay.
Your the technicians, let's say if you're working with a digital shop like you do,
yeah,
might be an SEO specialist or a CRO okay. specialist or a program or something. Those lend themselves more to contractor status.
Okay.
But the primary advantage of a contractor is emotional, in that it should be less emotional for you to not give them work than to lay off somebody. So if you have right. a regular contractor you're using just as if they're an employee, it probably doesn't make sense to do that. And you might want to have your own person who is a part of the team already. But it's also really hard to convert contractors because they're typically making more money individually per hour yeah. than you're going to pay them.
Yeah.
And so you just like, is this a job? Is this a role that lends itself to contractor status? That's the first question you ask.
Okay.
Is it important that this person's contribution be variable, because that lends yeah. itself more to a contractor, right?
Right.
And then do I want to build an ongoing relationship with this contractor and then eventually bring them on staff? There are a lot of contractors that really are full-time for one company.
Yeah, right.
Contrary to tax laws, they shouldn't
right.
be. But they but they just want to view themselves as independent entrepreneurs, and so they're not going to work for you. Those are the people that sometimes you just have to make an exception for because they're so yeah. important to your organization, but they don't ever want to be your employee. That's
right.
Fine.
Well, and just like in any entrepreneurship in this profession, there are no hard and fast rules, are there? It depends on, you know, a lot of times the positioning into some market, because sometimes the market you've chosen to serve actually can be served well with a certain kind of team structure as well. And you have to consider right. the market you're, especially if you're deep niched into a market, I guess.
Well, and sometimes you're borrowing the expertise of the person that you're using as a contractor, where you're newer into this, you're not ready to have a full-time person doing such and such.
Yeah.
You hire a contractor and borrow their expertise to help build your business moving forward. And that's perfectly adequate too.
Yeah. Well, is there ever a reason, I guess there's also the difference between contractors and team, is there's a huge cultural difference, obviously. Is there a time to get somebody out of your culture and say, you know what, you actually are a contractor. It's obviously what you want. You're not adhering to the culture. You're not part of the team. You won't participate. And so when do you get them off your team roster and put them into a contractor status, or do you right. just not do that? Do you just fire them?
No, I think it could be very viable to do exactly what you said. Somebody who is not a great fit culturally, but is really, really talented.
Yeah.
Those are actually the most dangerous people to keep on staff, because you keep them because they're very talented, but you're overlooking the fact that they don't fit culturally. So yeah, that would make sense. It's usually not a permanent move. It's usually just a transition where it's less painful than firing somebody. And so you do this, and then eventually the contract hours drop. Sometimes you even do that by giving them a client who may not be a great fit. They're both a bad cultural fit. And you say, listen, you go your own way. This will make it less painful for you. I don't like this client anyway.
Yeah.
And you get rid of both problems at once.
Yeah. Package them. It's a package deal. Send them on.
Yeah.
That's funny. Well, so If maybe typically we find labor being 45-50% of gross profit or whatever, generally, is that right? Is that right now? Is it higher? Has that percentage gone up a little bit, or
well,
what do you think about that labor metric?
It has gone up, but I don't think it should. It's sort of
okay.
like, you know, if my physician says, all right, you're 5'11", David, you should weigh 168. It's like, well, I say, well, I live in a city, or I like these kind of foods, or I'm certain, like, it doesn't matter. The standard
doesn't
is
matter.
The same. So,
okay.
yeah. More and more people are violating the standard, but that doesn't mean the standard's bad. It just means they're violating it. And I think it's going to come, it's going to catch up to them. I'm fine paying people a certain percentage of the total revenue, but if your revenue is not increasing to match that, and it's true, like the financial performance of of our branch of the professional services is the worst of all the branches. It's just true. When you look at our fee billings per full-time equivalent employee, you look at our net profit, you look at how likely our firms are to sell, we are the underperforming stepchild in every way. That doesn't mean there aren't any really strong businesses, but we tend to overlook some of the basic rules of gravity, thinking they don't apply to us.
That's funny. So, you know, as we're kind of wrapping up here, I mean, I'm interested about, because, you know, in this time post-COVID or whatever we are, I don't know, pre-recession, however you want to label what we're at, a lot of entrepreneurs are thinking about buying, selling. They're thinking about large transitions in their life. And so can you give us a little guidance on somebody that's thinking through, like maybe she's like, I want to sell my agency, I'm tired of this, or she's like, I'm, you know what? I'm seeing the opportunity to expand. I'm going to go acquire some agencies. Mm-hmm. What's a little guidance to help an entrepreneur know when to do that or when not to do it?
Mm. This is one of those rare opportunities where if you do all the right things, it helps you even if the result doesn't happen. So running your business as if you're going to sell it someday, even if you never do, means you're going to have a much better business.
Yeah.
So I love... A friend of mine wrote Built to Sell, John Warlow. It's a really good book talking about that. There is, so I've done, almost 200 equity transactions at this point. I've never been busier doing that. I think there's a lot more activity. Some of the activity isn't super, you know, it's more of an acqui-hire where it's not a full price acquisition.
Okay.
But there is a lot happening both on the buy side and the sell side. And if you run your business as if you're going to sell it, the odds, well, okay, so if you don't run it like you're going to sell it, you're just running a normal business, the odds are 1 in 400 that you'll sell it. That's really terrible odds, right?
Oh, that is bad.
But you can make some changes that just astronomically increase the likelihood of an exit. For instance, you could be certain size, you could maintain certain profitability, you could have a certain positioning, you could have different service offerings, you could have a different staffing structure. And then all of a sudden, your likelihood is 1 in 2 that you might sell it with a great exit. So it's one of those things where I feel like you ought to run your business if you're going to sell it, even if you don't have any intention. Selling the firm, because it's just so much better. It's so much healthier business if you do it that way.
Yeah. Is there, I mean, would you make a blanket suggestion to somebody to sell it internally to leaders internally, or to sell it outright? Like, or does that depend?
It really does depend entirely. It hinges on one thing. Do you have a likely successor on your staff who is an entrepreneur, a risk taker?
That's the
key. Because it's very unlikely that they're going to have the money to buy your firm. And so they're going to have to either go out and borrow it with, you know, just an SBA 7A loan or something like that. Or they're going to, or maybe the owner is going to carry the note over time, but it's going to require the internal buyer to sign a non-compete and so on, a personal guarantee. So it requires somebody internally who's willing to pay you what an outside buyer would. And that's pretty rare, but it's certainly worth doing. It's the least upsetting sort of a transaction, you know, because all the people are already there. The clients know this person already. So it's the best method if the person's willing to pay the right price. But if not, then you just look to the outside for a buyer.
Okay. Makes sense. All right, David, I promise I'm going to ask you one more question. This is the last one. So if you know, you're giving advice to people to sell their agency, and somebody says, okay, you know what? I think I want to do it. I want to run it like you're saying, like I'm going to sell it. And they say, but I'm not profitable. I'm breaking even, maybe 5% margins or whatever. Is there a first thing you would say, go look at this and start fixing this issue so that you can become profitable? There's a lot of complex things to look at, but what is the first thing you would say is going to give you some low-hanging fruit on turning that around?
I would say look at your pricing first. That'd be the first thing I would look at, because in nearly every single firm that fits the description you just gave, there is a significant degree of underpricing the work and or overservicing, but usually it's underpricing. In other words, whatever the price is you're giving to a client, based on whatever hourly rate you're using, because you're not doing package pricing or value pricing yet, you're still thinking hourly.
Right.
Whatever that is, it's not nearly covering the time you're spending. And so you accept that advice, then you have to say, okay, if you're going to start pricing things higher, you're not going to be closing at the same rate. So now you need a marketing plan. That's the second thing. And then you say, oh, I don't know how to build a marketing plan on our positioning. We're just a generalist firm. We're largely interchangeable with everybody else. So then you have to adjust your positioning. So you can see how each one of it's sort of like a remodeling project. Let's put a new countertop in, and then you're like, oh shoot, look at this needs it too. And it just goes on and on. But it usually starts with pricing, and then it goes all the way back to positioning.
Very cool. Okay. Yeah. David Baker, thanks for being on the show. This is some good stuff. I can't wait to do the second show next month. This is going to be great. And I always give people and tell people about your book, The Business of Expertise. Is there something else they should read? Of course, your articles on your website are extremely good. They're methodical and deep. Is there some other place you would send people to, or is it your site? Is that the best place to go to read
more? Probably the site. If you're not getting those free weekly emails, that'd be great. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the twobobs.com site is really useful. Between those two, that should cover most of it, I think.
Okay, it's great. All right, David, thank you for being on the Businessology Show. We appreciate it.